This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Fantastic to have you with us for another episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. A real mixed bag today, but literally something for everyone. Our tech editor, Danesh, was on the line as we look behind the headlines and asked, do you read the fine print? You might be shocked to find out how long it would actually take you if you did actually read it. He was taking your questions as well. And do you dry scoop? Do you? It is one of the fitness trends taking TikTok by storm, but it is definitely one of the more dangerous. Keith O'Malley-Farrell from Physical Training Company was on hand to sort fact from fiction. And when it comes to travel, it seems to be the hot question. Where are you going in the summer? Sarah Hedley-Hymers from Connect Travel was on the line explaining some of the options in Europe, plus the travel insider checklist that travel agents are using to make sure bookings don't go astray. And don't worry, you can use it too. Talking of travel, perhaps not of the leisure and pleasure, how about Baghdad? We were speaking to author Brendan Whittington-Jones. He's an animal lover. And upon hearing the news that Baghdad was falling, he'd got on a plane to go and save the zoo animals, not even knowing if there was indeed a zoo there. His incredible story has resulted in a book called The Accidental Invasion of Baghdad Zoo. And spoiler alert, it's a love story too. And from wild animals, lions and tigers and bears, oh my, to cats, dogs, hamsters and more. Pets and vets, as ever, every single Wednesday, taking on your questions. And it's Pet Appreciation Week. Many of you getting in touch to say why you love your furry friends.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
From books to tech, we are discussing gadgets this afternoon with tech editor Danesh Kandalawala. He is here on Microsoft Teams appropriately. Your hair is looking glorious, Danesh. I can see it moving in the AC breeze. we've had a question in for you already on 4001, so we're going in fast, if that's all right. Are you prepared? All right, let's do it. Text from Mum Sneha said, I need a good laptop for kids, not too pricey, maximum 1,000 dirhams, just enough to be able to do homework. Son is going into seventh grade, so needs his own device. This is the stage I'm dreading when they go, your children need to have their own laptop. I'm like, my kid cannot keep like a water bottle in their possession, never mind a laptop. So that 1,000 dirhams for Sneha and her son, anything come to mind?
There are a few. You have something called the Dell 3350, if I'm not wrong. It's not exactly a new model, but if 1,000 dirhams is the limit, then that's the case. The only suggestion I have is when you're looking for laptops, try not to buy the Intel Celeron processors, which is their cheapest version of processors. Try to go into the Intel cores, which is the i3s. There is the Dell, and I think there's a Lenovo, but the model number doesn't come to mind right now.
Danesh, can I ask, when it comes to getting a bargain, maybe it's for a kid, or maybe it's something that you don't need anything that high powered. What's the secondhand market like here in Dubai? Is there anywhere that's really regulated for checking out the products that they're selling, making sure you've got something of a buyer's guarantee when it comes to pre-loved electronics?
Right. So there's two sides to the conversation, right? One is you've got things like Noon. There's another one called Cartlo. I've used Cartlo a few times. These are all secondhand products or refurbished products at lower prices, sometimes really good deals, sometimes just a bit lower. Maybe it's an open box unit and things like that. So you've got that side of the market. And then you've got the other side, which is where you're dealing with everything and you have to verify everything on, let's say, something like Dubizzle. But that being said, I can easily say that for over 10 years, I've dealt with secondhand market in some way or another on both sides of the spectrum. And if you feel like you just can't deal with the process that comes with something like Dubizzle, you've got these options. Like I mentioned, Noon sells refurbished stuff, and Cartlo. These two things are there.
I hope that helps anyone out there. So I found my new favorite infographic. I love an infographic, by the way. I really do. It's just the way my brain works. And this shows how long it would take to read the terms and conditions of some popular online services. So it has got the likes of, well, Instagram, Tinder, Spotify, Twitter, yeah. LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, Apple, Amazon, Zoom, TikTok. By the way, my six-year-old asked me this morning, what is TikTok?
It's begun, Helen. It's begun.
I was like, it's really boring. I just kind of left the room. You're too old for it. You're 6 years old. So it took basically how long it would take you to read the terms of service agreements for these popular yeah. services. It blew my tiny mind, Dinesh.
Are
you someone, be honest, do you read mm-hmm. terms and conditions? Knowing everything you
no.
know.
Okay.
That's no. a hard no.
no. Not because I'm encouraging people to be careless or anything like that, but you have to understand what's behind these terms and conditions are massive teams of lawyers and experts in the field who know how to twist terminology. And in all honesty, I say this, even if you find something you can't agree to, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. The only option you have is to not use the app. Yeah. And in most cases like this, you can't.
So to give you some of the numbers, if you were going yeah. to read all the terms and conditions of Facebook, it would take you 17 minutes and 12 seconds. If you were yeah. going to read all the terms and conditions of Uber, 23 minutes, Zoom, 30 minutes, Tinder, 25 minutes. To be fair, that probably is one you should be reading. TikTok, 31 minutes, Spotify, 35. Mm-hmm. And it is Microsoft at a whopping 1 hour, 3 minutes and 30 seconds, yeah. more than 15,000 words in their T's and C's.
What's most important about this, and I laughed when I saw this infographic, was this is at the average reading pace of 240 words per minute. I want to know who you are. If you can read something so boring at 240 words a minute, I want to know who you are and I want to give you a hug.
It's Clark Kent. Have you never seen him doing speed reading? It's the only possible explanation. So let us know, do you read the T's and C's? By the way, for context, if you're going to read Macbeth by Shakespeare, it would take you only 7 minutes longer than to read Microsoft terms and conditions. 4001, let us know. Going to the text line, June's asking, can you retrieve an email on Yahoo Mail that you deleted a long time ago or any other email for that matter? Is there a time limit on these things or can you go deep into the archives, Dinesh?
Well, first of all, if you've deleted it and it's out of your trash, you have no access to it. It's done. Sorry, forget about it. But if it's in archives, that's a different story. Archives, every software, your Googles, your Yahoos, all have different time limits on archives. Some are forever. So like I have stuff on my Gmail archive, which has, I think, been there since school or university. But if you've deleted it and it's out of your trash, unless you contact Yahoo, but even then, I don't think anything would happen. To be honest, it's gone.
Sorry, June.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking tech, Dinesh is with us. Bruno, you're a clever man and a wise man to be asking this question. Bruno is saying, my grandma is inheriting my old iPhone. I've deleted all the photos and docs and other downloads, but how can I be sure that she can't access them? Prevention's better than cure, I think, a lot of the time, Bruno. So well timed.
So I think over here, I'm just going to assume that his grandma's nice and tech savvy. That's why he's worried. But if you've done a full factory reset of the iPhone, you're perfectly fine. If you want to be sure, you can do a second one. But beyond that, she'd need softwares to get into it, and I highly doubt your grandma's that interested.
Don't underestimate the silver surfers, Dinesh. No name on this one saying, any advice for an editing tablet for intermediate level photographers for both Lightroom and Photoshop? So an editing tablet for photographers in particular using that software.
Oh, iPad. No questions asked. iPad Air, 8th generation, the current one. If you can afford a Pro, nothing like it. But the iPad Air, hands down, eyes closed, buy it.
Interesting. Okay, there you go. Not a question as such, but I need to bring this to the world. A message saying, when I first arrived in Dubai as a trailing spouse 17 years ago, I was so lonely and bored that I read all of the manuals on the new appliances we bought. In the fridge manual, it explained that there would be a beeping noise if the door of the fridge was left open by, quote, naughty housewife or maid. A real welcome to Dubai moment. Thank you for sharing that. That is gold. Worrying, but also gold. Eamon, I'm curious, Eamon, how many photos do you have on your phone? I bet it's not as many as mine. I think we all could do with a bit of a photo edit. Eamon wants to know, is there an app that arranges pictures into separate folders like family, work, hobbies, etc.? My gallery is a mess. Android user here.
So I specifically for this purpose use Google Photos. Now, I don't know. So Google Photos does exist at a level where it's free for a bit, but then you have to pay for the rest. So I do pay for it. But Google Photos is just... Right now, it's the king. Apple is slowly getting there, but Google Photos, you put everything into the cloud. It arranges everything. You can search anything. I mean, anything. You can search car, and it'll give you every single picture with a car in it, including if there's a picture of you and there's a car behind you or an image of a car behind you. And it creates albums, creates animations, gives you memories. It's just such a good way of having photos. I personally think it's definitely worth that little extra cash every month. I think it's like 3 or 5 dirhams per month. But for me, I would suggest Google Photos.
For ease of use, easy to search. All right, hope that helps.
Definitely.
Dinesh, I'm glad we got you on today because something odd happened yesterday. Basically, the internet was down. What kind of services were affected and do we know why it happened?
So it was services like Amazon, Reddit, Twitch, Shopify. These were affected primarily, but this was because their cloud computing provider, which is a company called Fastly, they had technical issues on their part, which, well, on that scale is a massive piece of news and it went out everywhere. But it's something that does happen on a much smaller scale, whereas this took all, I think, over an hour and a half, where an hour later they started the repair process and stuff like that. At this level where it takes an hour, yes, approximation of damages for each of these companies would have been anywhere in the range of $250,000, so about 1 million dirhams. So it was massive from that perspective, but it's not something unseen and unheard of.
Someone lost their job about yesterday.
Yeah.
Someone got a call from HR. Dinesh, thank you for your time this afternoon, your insights and your answers. For people that want to follow you, and I know you could do some great videos around unboxing, reviews, the latest news as well. What's the best way to follow you?
I'm on Instagram, TikTok and YouTube on Dantalks, DANTALKS.
You're on TikTok?
Yep.
I think less of you. Can you talk to my six-year-old about why it's boring, why she should never go near it? I was like, it's rubbish. Don't do it. Do not go near TikTok. Dinesh, thank you. You are an absolute treasure as ever.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
I'm Keith O'Malley Farrell of the Physical Training Company. Now, we are talking fitness trends and some potentially dangerous myths that might be out there as well. Now, something that caught my eye over the weekend was something called dry scooping. It has gone viral on TikTok, and those in the gym business have known about it for years. But thanks to social media, millions of people now hearing about it, trying about it. So why should we care? And is it as dangerous as I'm hearing? Can you explain what dry scooping is, please?
I have to look this up after our previous conversation. It's essentially when you take your scoop of your pre-workout, and instead of adding it to water, you just put the whole scoop, powder only, straight into your mouth and swallow it.
Ugh, that sounds horrible. So if someone has a protein shake or as you say, some kind of pre-workout shake or supplement, they don't add it to water. You just literally just pour the powder in your mouth. That sounds absolutely rank. What do people claim the benefits are?
Well, I think this is specifically around the pre-workout. So the pre-workout is... most of them are designed to open your blood vessels. So they've got special ingredients in them that cause natural vasodilation. And it just increases blood flow to the periphery and you get a bit of an energy high and that kind of thing. So that's what the pre-workout mixed with water should do. So my guess is when you take it straight, it's almost like you bypass whatever slower digesting with the water is, and it just goes straight into your bloodstream. And then that can run the risk. I mean, with pre-workouts in general, everyone's a little bit different, but you run the risk of like getting these rosy, flushed skin, these tingly skins on your arms, your cheeks, sometimes get some heart palpitations. So they're not for everyone in general, whether it's with water or without. But I definitely wouldn't really be recommending just taking it without the water.
Sometimes massive amounts of caffeine as well, which is what led to people thinking of having heart attacks. Some people have had a heart attack. So please exercise caution, both literally and figuratively. Let's have a look at some of the myths that you think are, well, worth examining. Myth number one, it's normal to exercise. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think, so people kind of talk about how, and this, people are spinning things always back to our ancestors and how our ancestors never typically went for an exercise session. They were just active. And I think humans in general are built to be active, like any natural animal, built to roam around and do whatever needs to be done that's just not sitting at a desk or sitting on the couch. So I think that one's just like a language thing. I think they're just playing on words. We might not be built to exercise because modern world has termed exercise as in like you get off the sedentary activity that you're doing, you execute a physical thing, and that's your exercise, and then you go back to being sedentary.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's just language, but I mean, I think we're definitely built for activity. We're definitely built for movement.
Can I ask you a question? When we think about our ancestors and we think about them, I don't know, just chucking logs around and running from saber-toothed tigers, how do you think our ancestors would stack up to the, you know, the average modern man, you know, nose to nose, toe to toe? Who do you reckon would come out on top?
Standing toe to toe, you're going to see the modern human much bigger, much more of a bulky mass. Both male and female would probably be in better physical condition just statically, just looking at the two. Probably stronger, probably healthier, probably better at fighting infections. And then putting them against each other in a competition, strength and power and that kind of thing, combat, modern would win. In some sort of long-distance endurance or some sort of, you know, tracking across mountains and finding animals and hunting and those things, and maybe even building huts and finding fresh water, I would guess that the average prehistoric man would beat the average modern human at that.
Yeah, well, we have GPS, so that's also quite useful.
Yeah.
One thing I've been wanting to ask you for a while, actually, is about, we've heard it so many times recently, and especially around pandemic, where we've all been, you know, sitting on our backsides quite a bit, on the laptops, working from home, working from the sofa. Is sitting the new smoking?
I think this is one of those ones where people are just looking for a new scapegoat. And it's a nice banner when you're giving your corporate world the ergonomic presentation. You know, you got your fitness professional standing at the top of the thing, telling the whole corporation that what you're doing is wrong. Sitting is the new smoking. I don't necessarily think it's so detrimental. Like smoking, when you put the cigarette in your mouth, you're definitely causing a physiological change, which is going to catch up with you. Whereas sitting, you can bet that prehistoric human sat down. So the typical thing is that they didn't sit down at 90 degrees. They sat down either cross-legged or they sat down in a deep squat position. But I would almost give them a bit more credit than that and think that while those things definitely happened, they also will have, you know, created some sort of rock or a log type bench and sat down either when they're running across the country or whatever, the countryside or sitting around the campfire. They would have figured out that sitting is that comfortable thing. So they would have sat as well. Mm-hmm. The difference now, I think, comes from they were equally, if not more, active in relation to the amount of time they spent static rather compared to how we are nowadays. And the time that they were static was preservation and recovery rather than just getting your stimulus from a tablet or a TV.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
But we are looking at fitness myths. Is it fact or is it fiction? We've got Keith O'Malley-Farrell from the Physical Training Company live on the line. So we had a message saying ages and ages ago, read that 20 minutes prior to exercise, caffeine is good, so your muscles are fooled into being less tired. This was what, quote, some research found. Any truth in this, Keith?
Did you say the muscle was fooled or fueled?
Fooled into being less tired.
It's not quite like a masquerade. It's more that the caffeine stimulates your neural network. So you get a better transmission of electrical impulses from the central nervous system to the muscle, and then the nerves that are on the muscle are able to deliver more contractile force or energy, and then the more of the muscle works. So it's not so much that they're fooled, but it definitely some research and a lot of research will back the use of caffeine, definitely ahead of all the pre-workout stuff that you mentioned earlier on.
Now, something I've got a vested interest in. Myth, running will wear out your knees. I had a health check recently that told me my metabolic age was 24, but my knees are more like 84. I can't run a bath, cannot stand it. But is it true that running will just wear out your joints, especially your knees?
Like, if you took every human, the answer is no. That's a myth. Running is not bad for your knees. But taking your example, like, running is bad for your knees. You know, because if this is what the scan said, if this is what the condition of the bone is. So it's one of the ones where, like, as humans, we're built to run. We're biomechanically efficient running, moving around. We can run. But what's the predisposition of the single individual who is trying to run? Because for some people, it's absolutely bad for your knees. But it's not that it's the running that's causing the initial problem. There's some other, whether it's a huge weakness, whether it's a stiffness in one of the other joints, and then the running is all biomechanically sort of unsound, and then the knees, because they take such a brunt of the impact when you are running, it's typically the knees that will be the weakest part of that chain. But that's not caused by running. Usually it's some other issue,
like doing too much netball when I was 12. Let's blame it on that. Let's blame 12-year-old Helen. What about walking? Because this is something a lot of people start with when it comes to beginning an exercise regime. It is, you know, that mild to moderate exercise, walking, walking, walking. But can it lead to you losing weight? Is it effective?
It definitely is effective. And you've got to split up the gross term of just it's good for humans or it's not good for humans. Like, it's all about the individual. The people who have a ton of weight to lose and who can't exercise at such a high intensity because, like you just mentioned, maybe their knees break down, maybe their back starts to hurt, then walking is going to be the first strategy for them to lose weight. But also, if you wanted to just go to the periphery of opening a can of worms, there's a thing called your NEAT, which is your net energy, I can't remember, but it's basically like as you move around the day to day, that's really where you burn your calories. So yes, you have your exercise in the morning, and this is where this 10,000 steps marker has come in. And that's just typically from your day-to-day activity, just the rest of your moving around. And if you're not doing that running, then it's going to be walking. So for sure, walking is a massive part of anybody's weight loss journey. If you're just exercising for an hour and going back to sit at a desk all day, you're going to really struggle without bringing in those steps and that extra walking throughout the day.
Well, we've had a message on exactly that saying, I lost 60 kilos in 6 months during lockdown. So yes, walking definitely helped lose weight. Wow, incredible achievement. I wanted to ask you about a very common phrase, and we're not going to mention the well-known sports company that it's linked to. Just do it. And this is, I think, a lot of attitude that comes around sports, that just get into the gym, just get started, and that works for some, but not for others. How do you feel about the "just do it" slogan?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it does work for some. I think it doesn't work for others. Ultimately, they do have to do it. But the word "just" kind of indicates that it's as simple as,
yeah, just crack on.
Which is definitely not. There's tons of reasons why people can't just do it. If once you do it, it's great. You will see the results because it's going to work, doing it right, all of that kind of stuff. But often it's not just a case of that. It's just not that simple. Some people need huge support networks. They need massive motivation. They need to be encouraged. They're nervous. They're apprehensive. Whatever it is, they're injured. It's not a case of just up you get, off you go.
And that presumably applies to diet as well. I feel like a lot of people really judge themselves, have no self-compassion when they can't, you know, so-called stick to a diet, thinking it means you've got no discipline. It's much more complicated than that, surely.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at, I mean, if anybody wants to lose weight, they're well aware of the strategy of going on Google and pressing control, print, and getting a food plan. But it's not that simple. It's not just like a map where if you leave this destination A, you'll get to B. you've got to factor in, as a nutritionist or as a psychologist, why is the person having problems with their diet? What are they using food as a means for? Is it just fuel? Are they just looking at food as, I need this much for my metabolic rate? You can almost guarantee that it's not used in that sense. And this is where lots of the research and lots of the nutritional advice is given. Now, there is amazing nutritionists out there, and I wouldn't say that everybody's just printing out food plans. But when you don't succeed on a food plan, people often internalize that as they're useless, they have no discipline, they're not like all the other people. Whereas really, it's so individual and it's so much down to that person's psychology that's what needs to be brought to the forefront and discussed and supported and helped.
Couldn't agree more. Keith O'Malley-Farrell, thank you so much for joining us. He is a rehab specialist. You can find him at the physical training company along with classes at the training room as well.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking travel. It is the hot topic. Apart from what vaccination have you had done, it is what are you doing in the summer? Maybe we can help this afternoon. Sarah Hedley-Hymers is with us. She's the editorial director of Connecting Travel. It is the UAE's newest B2B travel title, and she is on hand to help. Sarah Hedley-Hymers, what are you doing in the summer?
Oh, a lot, I hope. I am doing all the research at the moment on where we can travel to as UAE residents. And hopefully I'll get round them all.
What's on your hit list?
Well, top of my hit list, because it seems to be the easiest to get to, is Greece. So I had a big conversation with the Greek tourism minister this week. I interviewed him on what the reality was of travelling, because I was a bit suspicious. I wanted to know what we can really expect. And he really put my mind at rest, Theo Harris did. He's a very nice man, and he's very positive about travel right now in Greece. Their figures are coming down every day, which is obviously reassuring. But also, some of the islands are entirely vaccinated now.
Wow!
So you've got these entire holiday destinations that are 100% vaccinated, and by the time we get into summer, maybe the bigger islands like Mykonos will be as well too. That is on the cards.
Interesting. So in terms of the minute, so travellers can now enter Greece, but what about that PCR test, Sarah? What needs to be done in terms of if you're vaccinated or fully recovered from COVID-19?
Well, this is the good thing with Greece, because it's asking for one of the following. So you can either go in there with a negative PCR test, or you can go in there with proof of your vaccination. So most of the people in the UAE are vaccinated now. The problem that they're having is they're vaccinated with Sinopharm, and Sinopharm isn't accepted in all countries. However, Greece is accepting that. So you can either just go in with your vaccination, or if you're not vaccinated, you can go in with your PCR test, or they're also accepting proof of recovery. So if you're somebody who isn't comfortable with being vaccinated and didn't want to go down that route, if you've had COVID and recovered, that also allows you entry.
Interesting.
So they're really opening it up now. It's a big part of the GDP, the gross domestic product for Greece. So they're very big on travel, and it's very important to them, their economy, their people, to get this back on the road. We've got to help save people jobs. I see going on holiday is a moral obligation.
Sarah Hedley-Hymers, the Queen of the World. Sarah Hedley-Hymers is with us this afternoon, travel professional and, as I said, the editorial director of Connecting Travel. She's been speaking to Tourism Minister Harry Theo Harris, and he outlined some of the requirements to enter Greece.
Either proof of vaccination, 2 weeks and two weeks after the second dose, or a proof of having the disease and having recovered. So, for example, a positive test, 2 months, up to 9 months in the past, enough time has passed so that people have recovered. Or finally, a negative test, for the time being a PCR test, but we're hoping to agree with our doctors pretty soon that we will also accept antigen tests. So those are the three requirements before you travel. When they enter Greece, we always keep monitoring a small percentage with testing, and that includes everyone. This allows us to sort of gather the viral load and the statistics that the doctors require of us in order to allow and make these arrangements. So it is a possibility, despite being vaccinated. vaccinated, that you might be tested. But because we have a very sophisticated artificial intelligence system, we move our testing capacities where the risk is higher. So effectively to the non-vaccinated people and to the countries that have a higher viral load. So as a result, we don't believe that we will have many vaccinated people from UAE being tested at the borders, but that is a possibility, and I need to stress that.
Harry Theoharis there, the tourism minister for Greece. The bars and restaurants in Greece are open, but what are the restrictions in place?
Well, mainly the issue is music. Music is not allowed on the, there's no live music, stuff like that. So we still are a bit conservative on that front. The scientists tell us that the spread of the disease when there's loud music is people lean closer together, they shout more, they spread the disease more. So this is something that we have to be conservative for a few weeks at least. And hopefully in a few weeks' time, we'll be able to do another tranche of liberalization of the rules. In general, the rules are a bit lax, more lax on touching and the surfaces and stuff, because they seem to be less of a threat and more strict on the air, the mask and everything, because that's what the scientists tell us is more important.
Interesting indeed. So Sarah Hadley-Hymers, if people are going, right, well, I fancy Greece and those requirements are absolutely doable. How do you get there? What is the current travel corridor and destinations looking like?
Well, we've got travel corridors between the UAE, a lot of other countries in the GCC as well, and flights have opened up. The existing Athens flight is going to be joined by Santorini service from the 9th of July to the 12th of September, so all through the summer holidays. And also Mykonos will be serviced from the 8th of July to the 8th of September.
It's on.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is. We're thinking about the summer. If you're staying close to home, if you're heading further afield, Sarah Hadley-Hymers is with us. She's the editorial director of Connecting Travel. It is the UAE's newest B2B travel title. And you've got a very, very, very useful bit of information up on the website that I want to pick your brains on. Basically, everything you need to travel like a pro. It's a checklist for travel agents, but us mere mortals can use it as well to make sure that we don't come a cropper on our holidays. Can you talk us through it?
Yeah, it's up on the homepage today. So if you go to connectingtravel.com, you'll be able to bookmark it, keep it, but do check it 1 week before you're about to travel, because there really are some things that people have come a cropper with. One of them is getting their certificates back with their vaccines and things listed, but their names have been spelled incorrectly by lab technicians, or there's been a slight mistake. It's essential that they match your passport. So whenever you're in getting your PCR tests or your vaccines, just make sure that your name, especially in, you know, for expats who are living abroad, you know how many times names are spelt wrong in this part of the world and nobody seems to mind. At the airport, there will be issues. Mm-hmm. So you have to check that. Check the languages, mostly English, so you're fine as long as it's in English. But if you're in any other languages, just check it's accepted. So those certificates need to be in the right language. You have to make sure that all the numbers and dates are on your certificate. So I know that I'm using the Al Hosn app now, which has got everything really well organized on it. It's a brilliant, brilliant app. But my certificate, I've also got like a card certificate with a stamp on. So just make sure when you're getting given anything like that, that the dates are on there and the number of doses, really important. Because your second dose, you can't travel anywhere until after 14 days. So you need to make sure that that's listed. And then with your PCR test, the maximum I've seen for all countries in Europe when I've been researching where we can go is 72 hours beforehand. So you just need to make sure that your PCR test is booked for that 72 hours before you fly. And then I would recommend that you pack physical copies of documents as well as your apps or your electronic copies, because I've heard of people getting to the airport at the other end and then their mobile, they've been using their mobile on the plane and they've used it all.
No.
And then their phone has died. So don't be one of those people. Have the backup, have the spares, send it to your husband's phone, send your husband's documents to your phone. Just make sure you've got a backup. If it's not a paper document, just make sure you have some way of getting to things, because obviously with your if for us traveling with our Alhotan apps, we're going to have to be able to keep those batteries going. So no playing Tetris on the plane for 5 hours.
Pack a power pack. You need batteries, extra batteries, folks. I hadn't even thought of that. Bear in mind, I am married to the man who has colour-coded Excel spreadsheets for our holidays. So he is chief Boy Scout all over the organisation. But as you say, these things change all the time. So you can find that on the Connecting Travel homepage. There's also a list of the documents required. So everything from vaccination certificate, your test results, recovery certificate, proof of COVID and entry forms as well. Sarah, we've talked about Greece. What other European destinations? I don't know about you, but I am craving green. I'm craving like forest
Ireland.
And grass and all of that, like lovely lushness. So let's talk Europe. Where can people be heading if they want to go to some cooler climes over the summer?
There is no greener country than Ireland. And Ireland is opening up, as luck would have it, on the 19th of July, which is the first day of our Eid holidays. So we can put that on our wish list. And that's open to all GCC travellers who are vaccinated, not Sinopharm vaccinated, though. So you've got to make sure that you've got the Pfizer for that one or the Oxford AstraZeneca for that one.
And in terms of flights, what do we know about direct access? Is that bookable at the moment?
Well, I've literally just got the information in about Ireland, so that story has just gone live on the website. But what I've found is the minute I get the stories from the tourism boards or the government saying this is now open, within a day you get the airline saying, right, we're flying there direct. So by the 19th of July, yes, for sure, they will be up and running. And the UK flights were all announced yesterday that they are up and running from around about the 8th or 9th. So yes. We'll be able to fly direct.
All right. Spain as well. People are having some much excitement booking Spain because we've actually got three Spanish destinations we can fly to from here in the UAE. Where's on the list?
So we've got Barcelona, Madrid and Malaga have all been put on for the 7th of June Spain opened. So just this week. So those flights are all on now. So we can go over, have some tapas. I can't wait. It's so exciting. Just thinking about being in Barcelona is like, oh, wow. So the flights are all on for that. They've all been announced. And they're quite regular from the 7th of June. You've got Italy as well. Italy has opened from the 2nd of June with these are all quarantine-free destinations. So that's from the 2nd of June. And from the 1st of July, we'll get some Venice flights to add to Milan and Rome and Bologna.
It is all happening. And I feel like it's actually really hard to keep up with everything. And for having spoken to a lot of people about their summer plans over the course of the last few weeks, especially those from the UK and really desperately wanting to go back, it's such a hard time to know when to make the call. You know, how long should we wait until seeing if the UK gets moved to green or more likely amber? When do we make the decision to abandon plans and tell family that's not going to happen? When do we make plans to actually go somewhere else? And I think that's what's really hurting people at the minute. It's that uncertainty. And I've kind of made my peace now with the fact we're not going to be going back to the UK this summer. I've told my mum it did not go down well. She understands, of course. You know, she understands that I'm not going to be spending several thousand pounds and 10, 11 days of my time with a four-year-old and a six-year-old in a Heathrow hotel.
Can't think
of anything worse. And then spend a few hundred pounds on PCR tests. It's not happening, Babs. I'm terribly sorry. It's just not going to happen as much as... But I think a lot of people are really holding out that hope. And as expats, it's really difficult because, you know, we might move to this part of the world hoping or expecting that we're going to be able to go and see family on a regular basis. And that's built into our expectations. It's built into our calendar. We've got these milestones and markers and things to look forward to. And we know that we haven't got that support system every day, but we can have amazing quality time with our friends and families. And I think a lot of people are just feeling a little bit heartbroken right now that that's not going to happen. However, we can go on some holidays instead and have a Zoom.
I don't think my flights back to the UK were booked for the first day of Eid, which is, as I was saying, July July 19th, and I think I was booked on the 16th. And my plan now is to postpone that to August and live in hope. I will go to Greece, maybe one of the other destinations I've talked about today, maybe Ireland, and then I will hope that, because I've still got a lot of holiday to use, because I haven't been able to use any holiday. So when we do resume travel, there will be a lot of traveling happening in the last 6 months of the year. Mm-hmm. And we asked DTCM, Dubai Tourism, when they were on stage at ATM recently, last month, what the formula was to get on this elusive green list with the UK. And they admitted that they hadn't been given that information. There isn't guidelines for how to jump through the hoops that the UK want us to jump through. And it's very difficult for us to understand, because obviously, you know, they're saying it's a transit issue, but then, you know, the UK is a transit hub in itself. Mm-hmm. So so hopefully, through sheer pressure of, you know, what the constituents want, because I'm sure all the, like you say, Babs isn't happy, right?
Hey, listen, my mum is well known for
a politician.
Hey, she is in regular contact. She loves an angry email to our local MP, who she hates on a very, very visceral level. No, but I think there is, you know, there's pressure and there's relationships. And my, in honestly, my heart just absolutely goes out to anyone who is desperate to be with friends and family right now, whether that is through someone being unwell or needing emotional support. There's an awful lot of people out there who, it's not just about going back and enjoying some cooler weather, it's about going back and really wanting to be with their loved ones and needing to. So I am thinking of you all.
Yeah, the weather's always rubbish when you go home in summer, right?
It's true.
You go home
in August
and it rains.
It's not why we go back. Sarah Hadley,
it's never about the weather.
It's, well, not in our part of the world anyway, love. It's always a pleasure. Thank you for getting us excited and breaking it down. Can you remind us of the website for anyone who wants to head over to that checklist and get themselves organised?
Yes, it's connectingtravel.com. And we're all across social media at connectingtrav.
Connecting Trav, love it. You're a star. Thank you so much. Talk soon. Lots of course, announcements coming over the weeks and months, and we'll be speaking to all of the travel insiders to keep you up to date too.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In conversation with the man, Brendan Whittington-Jones, who's written a book with one of the best names I think I've ever heard, The Accidental Invasion of Baghdad Zoo. I've got so many questions and I don't think enough time, Brendan. So would you mind... I don't even know where to start. Is this a real story? Is this a novel? Or was there actually an accidental invasion of Baghdad Zoo?
Yeah, there was actually an accidental invasion of Baghdad Zoo. As strange as it sounds, it is one of the oddest stories that I've been involved in. Yeah, so it's all true, 100%.
Where did you come into it? Why did you find yourself in this part of the world and somehow around what I can only assume are very wild animals? What's your own background?
So, yeah, I grew up in suburban Cape Town, South Africa, and through a whole lot of strange decisions, ended up working in a game reserve in Zululand in South Africa. And while we were watching the invasion of Iraq on television, like much of the rest of the world, my boss and I followed up on a silly suggestion by one of his sons that maybe if we were bored with the game reserve, we could try and find a zoo in Baghdad, see if we could help out. A few hours later, we made the decision that that would be the best thing to do, and then started navigating away through the politics and trying to understand if we actually needed paperwork to try and get across to Baghdad. We just didn't know. So it was sort of a sense of adventure, and then we decided to tack some purpose onto it.
This is unbelievable. I mean, I'm glad you are saying for real this actually did happen. So you grew up with some zoology as an interest, wild animals, David Attenborough, Tintin, all that, you know, all that good stuff.
Yeah. All the usual stuff.
All the great stuff. Turned it into a career. And then watching the news, realised, and actually I think incredibly insightful, because so many of us see conflict, hear about conflict, but we don't think about those day-to-day places, occurrences, people, animals, that have been affected in absolutely devastating ways. And of course, you being an animal lover, you then looked at Baghdad Zoo. So did you know anything about Baghdad or indeed the zoo before you got on a plane?
Nothing, actually, to be honest. The initial conversation was actually triggered by talk of the fact that the American forces found an abandoned zoo or a derelict zoo in Kabul when they first went into Afghanistan. So that was kind of it a couple of years later, and the idea just seemed, well, if a big city was being invaded, there was likely to be a zoo in there. At that stage, and people probably won't believe it now, but you know, Google didn't really have information on those sorts of things. So if you typed in Baghdad Zoo or Iraq Zoo into a search engine, then nothing came up. So we figured the first way to find it out would be to get my boss at the time, a guy called Lawrence Anthony. If we could get him across to Iraq and get him across to Baghdad, maybe he could drive around and try and find out if he could find a zoo. And then based on that, maybe spend a month fixing it all up, and that would be job done. Yeah, in hindsight, that seems ludicrous, but that was exactly the way it worked at the time.
So how did it unfold then in real life?
Well, he went across initially. He managed to get permission from the American Embassy in South Africa, and he flew across to Kuwait and managed to speak to a couple of military officials there and essentially lagged his way across the border with a couple of Kuwaitis and a rented car and a couple of medicines that they bought from a local pharmacy and got out of the Kuwait Zoo. And they drove through to Baghdad. It was obviously a long trip and obviously a fairly dangerous trip, but they managed to navigate their way through to Baghdad following street signs as you do. And after a few failed attempts to find the zoo and getting stuck at a few checkpoints where soldiers were understandably twitchy with people in small rented cars driving up to them, they were eventually directed towards a checkpoint that the people listened. It turned out that was where the zoo was, and American soldiers had found the zoo when they launched a ground operation into the park. Didn't know what to do with it. They found these starving, abandoned animals and were looking after them themselves, sort of using their ration packs and whatever food they could scrounge around.
They were the ones at that point who were trying to take care of animals who presumably were malnourished. The heat must have been a factor as well.
Correct, yeah. I mean, it was this time of year, well, essentially sort of April, May, so scorching hot out there. And they found the zoo that had been abandoned. The Fedayeen militia had taken over the park and the zoo a couple of weeks before the American invasion. And shortly before the invasion started, they kicked out all the staff. Obviously, they didn't want the risk and the inconvenience of staff members being there. So those animals were essentially abandoned for a couple of weeks. So obviously, it would have been pretty disgusting conditions that the American soldiers found them in. They tried as best they could to get a bit of water and food to them, but obviously, they were still engaged in battles at the time. So it was something that was a massive relief when Lawrence arrived, as peculiar as it was. Yeah, you had somebody that came with the intention to help them out. So the Americans, yeah, they really lapped it up. They took him on, and he became the guy, the go-to guy for them. They would take him backwards and forwards from the nearby hotel where they were staying to the zoo every morning in one of these armored personnel carriers.
And then at what point, I'm just trying to think about American hospitality, Iraqi hospitality, animals who might be understandably distrustful of someone who's come from nowhere and wants to be treating them, helping them. What happened when you arrived? What was it like on the ground sometime after Lawrence first got there?
I mean, it had been an amazing couple of weeks between Lawrence and one or two other international volunteers that had turned up, and the American soldiers had managed to get the basics sorted out. So by the time I got there, it was at a point where at least the animals were alive, those that hadn't been stolen, because the biggest damage, to be honest, was actually the looters coming in once the Americans had arrived in the city. The looters swarmed through, and the zoo quickly disappeared from a couple of hundred animals down to a couple of dozen, just people stealing everything from animals to light switches and generators. So by the time I got there, they'd managed to kind of piece together a basic plan. The animals were still in fairly bad condition, but it was a zoo that just had no infrastructure at all. You know, something like an office didn't have light switches or lights or anything like that. Everything had been stolen.
What animals were you looking after when you first got there? Can you paint us a picture?
Yeah, pretty much all that was left was the things with claws and teeth. So the things that were difficult to steal, like lions and bears. Anything else, whether it had been a duck or a monkey, something like that, those had all been taken. Ibex, anything that people could either eat or steal and then sell on. It was down to bears and lions and tigers predominantly.
Angry, hungry, distrustful lions, tigers and bears. Oh my!
Exactly. And the rumor existed that a bear had eaten one of the looters as well. So it wasn't like it was all snowballs.
Okay. So where were you staying at this point? You know, let's talk about the hospitality factor. Nice hotel, maybe a little glamping situation. Where are you staying, Brendan?
Just like that. So the Americans had taken over the El Rashid Hotel, which was kind of in the center of the green zone. They had stormed in there a little bit earlier, taken it over as essentially a kind of a makeshift barracks. And obviously the further you went up the floors, the more people were squatting out there. We were just lucky to be allocated to a floor where there were a couple of Department of Defense contractors. that were filming, and they happened to have their own little fiefdom up on that floor. And Lawrence had talked his way in to the community there, and they let us stay. So we had these old hotel rooms. There was no water at the time, and there was one central spout down near the old empty swimming pool in the front of the hotel, and that's where everybody that was staying in that hotel would wash or get buckets of water for their toilets. It carried those up the dark stairwell, and then in the evenings it was eating military ration packs.
Well, so you were financing all of this yourself when it came to finding medicine for the animals, you know, presumably an element of bribes and making things happen and just moving around town. There was no grant for this. There was no one presumed putting their hand in their pocket saying, guys, this sounds like a great cause, I'm there for you, and let's, you know, wear some logo t-shirts. You guys were doing this off your own back.
Yeah, at that stage it was just optimism. We just figured that at some point, if we carried on doing it, somebody would help us out. And in the early days, it really was pretty much the American soldiers who were helping sort of lift rice bags and chicken and things like that out of hotels or wherever they could find them to help out. There were aid organizations that started to trickle in. Wild Aid had an individual who came with a little bit of money. And it slowly kind of built like that. The American military, through the coalition authority, put a small little bit of money together in the beginning. And that was it. It was really just a case of making a plan. And whoever could buy a chicken or some food or something like that would chip in.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us on this Wednesday afternoon, talking about animals of a more wild nature now. Brendan Whittington-Jones is working on a game reserve in South Africa when he saw the news. Baghdad was having a terrible time, but what about the animals? Him and his boss travelled to the city, found the zoo and intercepted. They intended to stay a month, but it ended up being a lot longer. He's lived to tell the tale and is the author of the book, The Accidental Invasion of Baghdad Zoo. So they got to the city, they tried to look after the bears, the lions, but what was the long-term plan?
We thought the long-term plan was a month, which turned out was a terrible underestimation of things. After a month, we had barely scratched the surface. So, yeah, Lawrence was there for 5 months. I was there for a year and a bit. We honestly didn't think of the long-term plan. We thought we would have fixed this situation quickly. And once we got there and realized how idiotic we were, we just figured, well, you just got to keep staying because you just can't get the job done in such a short space of time. And every problem we fixed, we encountered something else that we thought would either be a great idea or something exciting or something that needed to be done. So we just kept going until eventually, by the time we left, it was a municipal zoo that was under government control again and pretty much funded by the local government.
And was that what you were working towards when you went over? You were thinking, we want this to be a well-run zoo with animals that are well looked after, or were you really just going in to see what state these poor animals were in?
Yeah, I think it would be ambitious to say we had a solid plan. We were just really going in there to see if we could find animals in distress, and we found that. And yeah, that's what we started working on. And it really became a day-by-day operation. And as the crew of Iraqis started to pull in, and a few extra people started helping out, that our ambitions then started to grow when we realized that the more people chipped in and the better things were getting, we realized then what was possible, and we started to have better ideas of trying to make it a more efficiently run zoo. Once we knew the animals were alive and we had food and water sorted out, then we started getting ambitious.
You know, we hear about soldiers, we hear about politicians, we hear to an extent about charities and organizations going in, putting boots on the ground to help children and distribute food, but we don't think about anyone who looks at animal welfare. I've never heard a story like this before. It feels like it's been just overlooked in history.
I think it's a huge element. I mean, if you dig around, you'll see little bits of it from World War II, little bits of it from other conflict situations. But there are now organizations that are starting to take it on as a serious issue. And it's something that we wanted to highlight in the book, that there are amazing people and amazing organizations across the world that get stuck in. Because wherever you have these situations, wherever you have these conflicts, there's animals. People have got pets, people have got livestock, there's zoos. And it's something that, to give the Americans credit, they've started factoring it more into battle planning. And we've encountered it through the civil affairs agencies. They're distributing a lot of vets into areas. Yeah, it's something that's gone under the radar. And I think what comes out in the book as well is that just the local population started to embrace it as well. We just had amazing support from people that were keen on the zoo, people are keen on helping the dogs and the cats that started ending up at the zoo, you know, local staff adopting animals. It was just a really radical mind shift for us to understand how these things really work. It's really very much out of the media eye at the time.
Was there any point where you just wanted to go home?
Not really. Actually, it became such a novelty that it was hard to give up. It actually became quite addictive because you could see the progress you were making. And it's amazing when you get to operate, oddly enough, if you're not being paid by anybody and you've got nobody telling you what to do or what not to do, the freedom that comes with that is incredible. And obviously the novelty of being able to work in the gaps between American bureaucracy and Iraqi bureaucracy and getting these outrageous things done that you could never believe in a normal kind of organized society, it just left you wanting more.
Well, it did leave you wanting more because this wasn't your first foray into rescuing zoo animals. Your last, rather. What did this lead you to do, Brendan? You have ended up becoming a bit of an animal saviour.
Yeah, through North Carolina Zoo came into the game through Iraq and linking up with that in Zoological Society of London. They still had a finger in the game in Kabul, and that zoo was obviously going through a lot of struggles and there's obviously a lot of political upheaval there, even after the initial invasion. So that was something that the opportunity came up to try and get across to Kabul and help there as well. So that was a number of trips backwards and forwards, trying to get some of the logistics on the feet there. Yeah, amazing opportunity, just very different to the situation in Iraq, which had infrastructure before. Obviously, Kabul had been under war sort of situations for so many decades that it really was a bit of a crumbled mess.
What's brought you to the UAE?
My wife. She's a veterinarian. Funny enough, she is the vet who volunteered as an Iraqi veterinarian at the Baghdad Zoo. She now works at the veterinary hospital as the manager there, and yeah, I came across following her.
Hang on. Sorry. You met your wife while helping out at Baghdad Zoo?
Yeah, so she was a veterinarian who saw on a scratchy live feed, she saw my boss on a television screen that she sort of incidentally was watching at the time and decided as an unemployed veterinarian that she would volunteer at the zoo because she just thought it would be something cool to do. As an Iraqi, helping out, and obviously she just became a huge asset. She spoke Arabic, she spoke English, and she had the drive to get things done.
And then you fell in love. Oh, this is just the happiest story, Brendan. and what are you working as yourself here in the UAE?
I work for the Sharjah Environment and Protected Areas Authority at the moment. More kind of landscape protection than individual animals.
But it's good to know, with lions and tigers and bears, that we've got someone well qualified at hand should we ever need you. Should anything kick off in the springs again, I've got your number.
Yeah, exactly.
Brendan, for anyone who wants to learn more about this incredible story, the highs, the lows, the lions, tigers, bears, violence, and a love story as well, this is The Accidental Invasion of Baghdad Zoo. Where can people find the book?
Yeah, so the book is available on Amazon. So the paperback version is on Amazon.ae and Amazon.com. And the Kindle version is on .com and .co.uk.
This is Father's Day presents times two, sorted out, husband and dad. Thank you very much, Brendan. Really appreciate your time today. And what an incredible story. Thank you so much for sharing it.
Thanks, Helen. Thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the trusted expert in nutrition for your cat and dog.
It is Pet Appreciation Week, and I love the messages that are coming in. And in other heartwarming news, the surgeons at Modern Vet recently saved the life of a little Pomeranian called Holly. She was suffering from a serious congenital heart defect, known as PDA, which is, I think of PDA being something nice, but this is a different kind of PDA. And we've got Dr. Jose joining us from the Modern Vet Clinic to explain more. Doctor, how are you?
Hello, Ellen. Very well. Thank you. Well,
huge congratulations to you and the team. Can you tell us about this little Pomeranian, Holly?
Absolutely. First of all, thank you for having me. And it's really a pleasure to be part of your show.
Thank you.
So Holly was a Pomeranian puppy that was diagnosed with a loud heart murmur during one of our first veterinary visits for vaccinations. And upon further investigation, we noticed that it was a PDA, so it's an embryonic vessel that connects the aorta and the pulmonary artery, the two major arteries that leave the heart. And unfortunately, it's a serious problem because if left untreated, it's literally a death sentence for the puppy. So most dogs will die within a few months to a couple of years after diagnosis. But luckily for Holly, we managed to pull through the surgery. It was the first time in Dubai. It was very successful, and Holly is now fully recovered and expected to have a normal life.
I love a little waggy dog story. So If you hadn't picked up on this in during this routine check for her vaccinations, as you say, this diagnosis, the outcome would have been pretty grim. A couple of months left to live, maybe a year. So can you tell us about what happened in the surgery? How many people, how long did it take?
It was a relatively long surgery. It took us about 2 hours. The team was comprised of five veterinary surgeons. So we had performing the surgery Dr. João Figueira and Dr. Silvério Muniz. Big kudos to both of them. They did a brilliant job. We had Dr. Cristina Epifânio managing the anesthesia. And we had Dr. Farouk also assisting in the procedure. I was overseeing, managing the operation. I was the veterinary cardiologist, essentially responsible for the diagnosis and outcome of that patient. It was the first time we did it, so everyone was obviously a bit nervous, but everything went really well, and everyone did a brilliant, brilliant job. I'm really proud of everyone, and obviously super happy for Holly and her family. Mm-hmm. It's a lovely story, and it's really heartwarming for all of us. You know, it's literally the reason that all of us decided to become vets. It's so that we can make a big difference in some pets and their families' lives, like we did with Holly.
And I think, you know, you say 2 hour surgery, you know, as a pet owner and dog lover myself, I mean, I'm sure that I can't imagine the stress and nerves that poor family was going through. I wanted to ask you, Doctor, do you have any advice for owners of pets who might need to be trying new techniques, new surgeries, or even new medications that they might be nervous about?
Absolutely. Look, I'm a pet owner myself, and I always get super nervous when my cat is sick. I don't treat my own cats. I always take it to see colleagues of mine. What I would advise people is it's important to do their own research, you know, but don't trust Dr. Google too much. It's important to have a trusting relationship with your vets. And whenever you're going through a difficult situation with your pet, don't be afraid to seek a second opinion. You know, it's not offensive towards the vet that's managing the case. And at the end of the day, you need to be comfortable and you need to feel safe that what's being done to your pet, it's in their best interest. So mm-hmm. If it's something that's making you nervous, just take as much time as you need, discuss it, seek second opinions, and only go ahead when you feel absolutely safe and comfortable that you're doing the best choice.
Thank you for that. Now, it is your first time on Pets and Vets, which means I don't know anything about your animals. So you said you have a cat, and you should know that while I love getting people's names on messages on 4001 or on the app, I'm frankly more interested in what their pets are called. I love it. I love a human name. My dogs are called Jarvis and Lucy. Lucy, we adopted. We were her third home, so I was delighted that she did have a human name. What is your cat called?
My cat is called Shizuka. It was a name chosen by my wife, which I think comes from a cartoon, manga cartoon, something like that. But with time, she became Zuki. Oh. We mostly call her Zuki. So it was Shizuka, Zuki, and no, just Zuki.
It is bananas, the things that you find yourself calling your dogs, like the cats, the nicknames that seem so normal. And then someone comes to the house and they hear you. And I'm like, hey, Loose Goose. Okay, I can hear. I'm hearing it through your ears. Just let's never talk about this again. But it is Pet Appreciation Week. So many of you getting in touch to share why you love your animals. Can I ask you, Doctor, from a veterinary perspective, and you know, what do you think we as humans get out of having an animal in our life?
Oh, absolutely, much more than we even realize. The sort of unconditional love that you get from a pet, you cannot even compare to the love you get from anywhere else, you know. And the pets can promote a lot of benefits in your life, you know, from a physical and mental standpoint. So pets help relieve the feelings of loneliness, feelings of seclusion. They bring meaning to older people's lives. They are super important in children when they're growing up. From a cognitive standpoint, they make kids feel responsible. They are caring for another life. They generally become less egocentric when they grow up with pets. And from a health standpoint, it's proven that kids that grow around pets are less prone to develop allergies later in life, you know. And it's also known that stroking, cuddling dogs and cats really relieves blood pressure, you know, lowers your blood pressure. So there's a bunch of benefits, I believe. It's literally one of the best things you can have in your life. It's a nice companionship with a pet.
I couldn't agree more. And I love you mentioning the unconditional love, though. And I think back to, we had a family dog growing up, but the first dog I had as a grown-up was Lizzie, and we adopted her when she was 8, so, you know, a senior dog. And I really hope my husband's not listening to this. I've never known love like it. It was just the most pure, gorgeous love that's in, you know, I feel like we think about animals sadly passing, and it's a real grief. You know, these animals are part of our lives, and it's uncomplicated, and it's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing to for me to have in my life and me and my children's lives. And when that dog comes in and just flops down next to you, wants to be close to you, you feel their heartbeat, you take the time to stroke them and be close to them. I think you're right. Physically, there's absolutely no denying the benefits there. It is Pet Appreciation Day. So many of you getting in touch, and we've just had this message.
My name is Gabriel, and I'm 11 years old, and I'm getting my first dog, and I've named it Frankie Bear. It's a husky mixed with another dog. We're not sure, but we're getting it on Sunday. It's going to be my first dog ever. We asked the landlord. The landlord was fine with it. Then we eventually finally set in the deal, and we're finally getting a dog. And I'm very, very, very excited.
Oh, Gabriel, I'm so excited for you. Him and his family getting a husky mix, bringing that dog home. Frankie Bear, that. Now that is a good dog name.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the animal before the owner.
We are here to help this afternoon. Not me specifically. I do not have a veterinary degree, although I should do after a few years of doing Pets and Vets. At least a couple of letters after my name. It is Dr. Jose from the Modern Veterinary Clinic joining us to take your questions and loving your messages. It's Pet Appreciation Week. So tell us, why do you love your furry, fluffy, scaly, spiky friend? And you could be winning a goodie bag from Royal Canin just for them. No name on this one, but the animals are named, so I'm happy. Thanks, Jeffrey and Gary, for making our hearts melt, being so patient when three kids are all grabbing at you and just being our therapy. You're amazing and we love you. And we love our pet Bella the cat, especially when she gives our toes little nibbles. It's her way of showing affection. Unfortunately, it freaks out our guests who think she's just trying to bite them. And here's Liz.
I have a Labrador retriever, Molly. She's 3 years old. And like all the other dogs that I've had growing up and since I was an adult, she reminds me of how much fun the simple things in life, like going for a walk or going for a swim, can be so much more enjoyable when you're with your best friend.
Yeah, it is indeed. So let us know yours, 4001, or use that ARN messenger app. Going to the text line on the question front, Doctor. A message here saying, I want to ask what breed of dog is better to join for my cats at home, and any tips for introducing dogs to cats. Is this a breed thing, or can it be a pure personality thing?
Well, I would say it's most likely a personality thing. You'll find dogs that are very at ease with cats and others not so much. The challenge is mostly for the cat to accept the dogs. Dogs naturally are very curious and eager to please and to play. And specifically, if you get a dog from a young age, she will be very comfortable around the cats. The other way around, not so much. So generally, the trick is to take things slow, to give the cats time to understand that the dog is not a threat and to feel comfortable about him, and let them get together and interact at their own pace. So do not force contacts. Let them first smell each other, hear but not see, and with time then organize play dates under supervision until you're completely safe that they're comfortable around each other.
Can I ask, you said that, you know, they need to know that the dog's not a threat. What if the dog is a threat? what if he looks at those and goes, cats are snacks?
It can be, and it's something that people need to be aware. So dogs and cats naturally don't coexist. I'm not saying that it's not possible. I have lots of clients that have dogs and cats and they live in fantastic harmony, but it's indeed a challenge. And I don't think anyone would like to put their cats health or safety at risk by adopting a dog. That's why it needs to be a very thought decision and then very carefully. I would say most dogs if they are used to being with a cat since a young age, they will be fine. But getting an older cat that may already have developed aggressive behavior towards cats throughout his life, that may be a bit harder to break. So, yeah, I think the trick is to take things slow and make sure that they're getting along well before leaving them alone.
Okay, hope that helps. Staying with cats, Nadi wants to know, is summertime shedding season for cats? Do cats have a shedding season, especially here in the UAE, where it's definitely getting a bit George Michael, a bit wham out there?
So cats and dogs, they usually shed according to light cycles. So when the light cycles increase or decrease, they will shed a bit more. Temperature can also influence it a bit, but then there's a bunch of other factors, individual health factors and diet-related aspects, and obviously stress as well. What I would suggest is when cats start shedding a bit more, to brush them more regularly. There are a bunch of fantastic brushes out there in the market specifically for de-shedding, and they do help a lot. And it's important specifically in long-haired cats so they don't get matted and knotted hair, which is really, really uncomfortable for them. Obviously, another option is to get them groomed. Cats don't usually love it, but it does make them feel more comfortable afterwards.
When you say they don't love it, we know some cats and indeed some vets where sedation is necessary. Is that safe?
It is. It's safe and recommendable because at the end of the day, the stress created by grooming an animal by force or any other veterinary procedure by force, you know, it can be very, very traumatic and very dangerous for the pet. That's a problem I encounter frequently when I'm seeing patients with heart disease. Sometimes we do need to sedate them for examining, you know, to do a cardiac ultrasound, for example. And people are often concerned about the sedation. But from a cardiology standpoint, it's safer to have the animal under sedation and not stressed than to have their hearts literally pounding out of their chest on the table. So sedation, if done by a veterinary professional, it's safe. It avoids a lot of complications that can arise from an animal being stressed through a procedure like grooming unnecessarily.
Thank you, Doctor.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the trusted expert in nutrition for your cat and dog.
We're talking animals, and it is Pet Appreciation Week. Jessie says, my little pooch literally saved me during the pandemic. I had no one to turn to, and I was really stressed out and locked inside my apartment. And Dean says, my wife and I have decided not to have a baby yet, but we have two dogs, and I can safely say they are the reason our marriage works. Oh, it's just lovely. Joining us to answer all of your questions, we've got Dr. Jose joining us. He is there at the Modern Veterinary Clinic. Going to the text line, no name on this one, doctor, saying, I have a dog with a dust allergy, so she's on a maintenance dose of 2 Apoquel per day. Will she ever go out of this? 3 years old, and the minute she comes off it, her belly skin becomes red. Dust allergies in dogs. Any insights there?
Yes, so it's quite common. Allergies are one of the most common veterinary problems worldwide nowadays. We do see a lot of animals for skin-related conditions, most of them allergic, and they can be quite difficult to manage because until we identify all the causes, all the triggers, the animal does have to stay on medication. Apoquel is a fantastic drug because it's very safe and the animal can stay on it for long periods of time, including forever if needed. But if possible, a thorough investigation into the allergens would be good. Most of the times it's not the dust itself, but dust mites. So also deworming your pet regularly. So trying, for example, spot-ons or inclusively tablets that have activity against mites can help, because dust itself is not usually the allergen. It's more the mites that live in dust.
Thank you, Doctor. Sunil's been in touch saying we have a mini Yorkie called Chuck. Chuck has pancreatitis and is on a strict low-fat diet, but increasingly his food is out of stock because of COVID in Europe. Is there an alternative that I could feed him? What do we think?
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially, the diet for pancreatitis is, as Neil said, the low-fat diet. So if it's not possible to procure a commercial diet, you can always try to cook a diet at home. It's not ideal. I always prefer prescription diets when possible, and there are several brands available in the UAE, several options. But when that's not a possibility, we can try either raw diets or home-cooked diets. Just avoid fatty ingredients. So for example, if he just uses a bit of chicken breast that's not very fatty and some rice, some veggies, that's a relatively safe diet.
Thank you, Doctor. I hope that helps, Anil, and little hugs to little Chuck. No name on this one, but we do have the name of the dog, so I'm happy. Message says on 4001, our lovely boy is 7, a lab mix called Milo. And although he cocks his leg on walks, he's always squatted at home on the lawn. Not a problem. But the past few weeks, his wheeze are literally killing patches of our grass. I'm just wondering if that's a change that happens with older dogs or if it's something that is wrong.
In labs, it's always important to consider chronic joint disease because they are very, very prone to that. So at 7 years old, he's not a very old pet yet. We start considering dogs geriatric when they're 7, 8 years old, so he's starting to get there. But any change in behavior and toilet habits should be investigated. And specifically considering the breed, I think it's important to have him checked by an orthopedic surgeon to see if he's not in pain, because quite possibly that's a way of him to avoid pain.
Mm-hmm, trying to protect himself. Okay, I really hope that helps. And all the best to Milo and also your lawn. Janice has been in touch asking the question I think a lot of us have when there's been a procedure, an operation. Do you need to make your animal wear the cone of shame? Janice saying, Roxy was spayed yesterday and within 5 minutes of getting home had managed to get her cone off. Spent the whole day following around, putting it back on, and around midnight I ordered a cat suit on Amazon that will come tomorrow. What a time to be alive. I woke up this morning, she's got the cone off again. Not sure how long she's had it on for. I've spent the day trying to get back on. Vets said she must wear it for 10 days. Basically, does she need to wear the cone? Janice saying, once she gets it off, she doesn't go to lick the wound, but does groom the surrounding area.
I would say as much as possible, yes. I'm not going to go into details, but I've seen quite catastrophic situations of pets that remove the cone after surgery. I think she had a brilliant idea procuring a cat vest. It's usually more comfortable and the animals tolerate it better. But above all, she needs to find a way to mechanically ensure that she cannot reach the wound, because if she does leak it, can cause serious problems there. And as much as we want, we cannot have our pets monitored 24/7. You know, so even if she keeps the cone off or the vest off when she's with her dog, but tries to place it back on again when she's left unattended, I think that would be ideal. Just don't leave the wound unprotected for the first week, at least, if not 10 days, at least the first 7 days.
All right, really hope that helps. Seema has been in touch on 4001. Seema is 9 and says, Vostok is a lovely, cute dog who gives the best cuddles and is super playful. I love you. You are my little brother. And that's why I love kids and pets together. Mine cuddle like you wouldn't believe. It is adorable. It really, really is. A message here saying, our poodle puppy is 9 months old and a whiner. If he wants anything, he whines. To get in, to get out, he whines. I'm concerned every time I ignore it that it's hugely irritating to neighbours, and they have commented. How do I deal with this? Whining dogs. Not a wiener, but a poodle.
It's a difficult one. That's the classic emotional blackmail. I think we've all experienced it as pet owners.
I can even do it. Our dogs go, arr, and you're like, oh, it's so annoying. I just want to stop you whining. Stop it.
It's very, very difficult to control that, because at the end of the day, I as an owner personally, I feel sad for them. You know, when they do this, I just... I can't help but just whatever they want, and be it lonely or sad eyes or the whining, it's very difficult to ignore them. But I completely understand the concern, and specifically when we live in apartment buildings that have neighbors around, it can be difficult. It's a tricky question, because telling the dog off is not going to help, quite likely to make the opposite effect, actually. So ignoring may be the solution, because on the long term, the dog will understand that whining has no effect. But obviously, in the beginning, it's going to be difficult for the neighbors. Although there's always the option to procure or to seek the help of a veterinary behaviorist who may help understand better this behavior and ways around it. This is not an uncommon problem, and behavior medicine is really, really important, because it's extremely relevant in the dog's quality of life. You know, if there are behavior issues, they're going to impact the pet's and the owner's lifestyle. So those should be treated seriously. So if home management of the situation isn't being effective, I think it would be wise to seek the help of a veterinary behaviourist.
Thank you, Doctor. Lorraine has been in touch saying, I have lots of cats, but one has kidney issues. Can I feed all the cats on special kidney food? What do you think? Can one come all? Can they share food, or do you need to be careful about keeping them separate and their food separate?
It's not super bad that the other cats eat the kidney diet. It's not like the diet is toxic for the other cats. It's just the diet has specific nutritional requirements for patients in kidney failure. So it will have lower levels of protein. It will have lower levels of phosphates. So for younger cats that are growing and have higher activity levels, higher energy levels, they will lack the extra protein. So I don't think it's a problem that all the other cats eat the renal diet, but maybe try to compensate the other cats with a few treats here and there, or with a higher calorie meal here and there. But it's not going to harm them. Essentially, it should be safe.
Thank you so much for your time this afternoon, Doctor. Really, really appreciated it. Huge congrats again to you and the team at the Modern Veterinary Clinic on saving the life of little Holly the Pomeranian. We have put a photo of you and her up on our Instagram stories if anyone wants to go and have a little look. So thank you. Really, really appreciate it. And we'd love to talk to you soon.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune in to Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.